basically had to hammer it down a little bit and carry all the pieces with me, and it's a logistical nightmare.
In the post-Fordist reality of late capitalism, we find that the semi-elastic pliability of blue tack is also a quality demanded of us.
Oh, hey, how you doing? I'm Samantha Groth. This week on All the Best, we've made it through the end of financial year madness. The sales are done, donation campaigns are over, and that tax return may well be on its way. But there's still a pinch in lots of pockets. So on this episode, we're thinking about the different ways people get thrifty. We're talking savings, sales, and even the side hustle.
To the story now.
Depending on who you ask, having a 9-to-5 job is a big part of the Australian dream. You clock in, you clock out, you work Monday to Friday, you have the weekends off. Every fortnight or so, your pay lands in your bank account. Life is pretty sweet. But for some people, that's not the right fit. Their day job isn't fulfilling, it doesn't pay enough, and they need a way to supplement their main income. The answer? Side hustles. Something outside the 9-to-5 that pays up. You might babysit the neighbour's kids, sell your stuff online. Or, if you're bold, you take off your clothes and let people draw you. Naked. Nadia is a freelance illustrator and graphic designer by day. She also has a unique side hustle.
I have two freelance jobs that I go to physically. Neither of them are really in a space that I feel passionate about. Well, one of them's a graphic design sort of company. A lot of print and digital material sort of churned out, kind of having to get an eye for this sort of stuff that if I saw it in the letterbox, I wouldn't even necessarily look at it. The other job is for a startup, and so I'm the only graphic designer in-house there. And that's a bit challenging because, again, I would like to be working with other creatives and collaborate more. I do work around other people, but it's a bit isolating because we're all doing very different things and no one really has any guidance or any... they're not really inspired by the same things. My main side hustle is life modelling. It's like, oh, that exists and I can try that. Like, okay. Also something that doesn't need my brain in the same way. A lady approached me in the bathroom at Woden when I was 16. Just said she had like some private classes with some people and asked if I wanted to be their life model. But yeah, that sounds kind of dodgy now that I'm saying it, like I was in a bathroom. My dad was cool with it, but my mum wasn't. Like, I've posed nude for a friend's art show before, and when my mum found out, she was pretty horrified. I've never been that uncomfortable with nudity. Like, that's one reason why it was quite easy for me to decide to do it, because I've always felt really comfortable naked. I take off my clothes and put on a dressing gown. Like, you have to bring a dressing gown. Like, you need your own. And that was really fun, buying a nice dressing gown. I really enjoyed that process. So you go and you put on your robe and you come out and everyone sort of is like, oh, and this is the model for today. When I was in Canberra, I modeled for the ANU. The first time, like at the beginning of a semester, it was really awkward because I think students don't know if they're allowed to look at you and I don't know if I'm allowed to look at them. And when you're naked especially, like there's just a lot of... It's a very different social terrain. So let's say it's a charcoal class. You stand in the center. I prefer to take off my robe when I know they're about to start drawing. Like, I don't really want to be there naked for too long. Sometimes I'd have to do 16 poses or something in succession without really having thought about what I'm going to do. The next ones will be a bit longer and then longer again, and then there'll be like a couple of 20-minute poses potentially, and that's when you're like reclined or sitting. And then at the end, you put your clothes back on. Everyone's just sort of assessing each other's work and you just slip out. I say bye and then leave. It felt really good. Like, it felt very tangible, like a tangible skill that I was good at. And it felt, yeah, felt really satisfying.
Why do you think you're a good life model?
Are you challenging me? I used to be very fidgety, I think less and less these days, but I'm just very good at being still. I did Vipassana a couple of times. The Vipassana 10-day course is 10 days of silent meditation. You don't make any eye contact, any gestures with anyone. You meditate for about 14 hours a day and you just sit very still, and it's very much about observing what's there. I can hold some quite difficult poses for quite a bit longer just because I have a sort of awareness of micro movements in my muscles. So if I feel something's about to go a bit numb in my leg, if I just sort of move it very like slightly in the right way, then it can kind of make the blood move again. And it's not like a huge paying job, and it is actually quite, it is really hard work. It's very different from the other sort of draining office work or being behind a computer. It feels like a good sort of tired at the end of the day. The most confronting is perhaps when I'm still in the center and everyone has to swivel their artboards around so they're all facing me. And so then I see myself, or like whatever it is, like these works depicting my body from various levels of skill and different sort of styles. And it's hard when you see people's works and you kind of go, nice. And because the ones I want to take photos of are the ones where my butt looks really good, and then I feel really vain, and so I just don't take any photos, you know? But I do appreciate their work.
Side hustles are handy if you want to pad out your weekly paycheck. But what if your 9-to-5 job doesn't pay at all? That's a reality for a lot of stay-at-home mums, like Lynn. Lynn lives in Sydney and has raised 3 children. They've all moved out of home now, and she's found she's got some extra time on her hands to work out a new, successful side hustle.
Come on, let's get the lid on. Right, now I'm just going to take Adam for a walk. I became a primary school teacher. I worked at that for about 10 years, and then I studied teacher librarianship. That was great, and I was just really starting to enjoy that when number one child came along, Emily. And so I didn't have any family support in Sydney, so I stopped work and devoted my time to looking after children. But I was still wanting to use my training, so I started volunteering for the Girl Guides. Oh, definitely there was some downsides to being a stay-at-home mother and just doing volunteer work, and that is that I always felt that women in my position weren't valued like a person in the workforce would be valued. And now, you know, I know, look at mothers that are doing full-time work and raising families and everything, and I just really admire them. But it must be pretty tough. I don't think I was tough enough. Our last dog, Harry, he lived to a grand old age of 16 and a half, and he died about 4 years ago. And I found myself in a real predicament. All my children had left home, and the dog had died, and the cat had died, and I thought, well, what am I going to do with my life now? So I thought, I'll do a bit of travel, and a lot of people my age like to, you know, do some serious travel and go overseas and explore the world. So I was busy looking in the travel section of the newspaper where I saw this tiny little ad, and it said wanted dog minders. So I followed that up and got onto the website, and I joined an agency looking after dogs in my own home, and I found I really enjoyed it. The first dog was a Labrador. His name was Rocky, and we had him over Christmas, and he was so much fun. He was a really great dog, and, you know, Christmas Day we put a Christmas hat on him, and he took a photo of him sitting next to the Christmas tree, and then we sent the photo off to the owners, and, yeah, he was my first dog. He was a beauty.
This way, come on. The
normal time a dog would stay is, well, there's no normal time, anywhere from 3 or 4 hours just for the day. You know, some dogs come for daycare and some dogs come for 5 weeks. You know, if their owners are on a big overseas holiday, then they come here and they have a nice time at their second home with Auntie Lynn. I call myself Auntie Lynn. Yeah, and, you know, we just treat them like we would have treated any of our other dogs that we had during our life. That they're just part of the family, and, you know, feed them and walk them and talk to them and clean up after them, and, you know, they just have their normal family life, and but yeah, it's just their second home. I hope they usually like coming here. Yeah, most of them run up to the front door with their tails wagging. And having the dogs has been great according to my family, because all my children are very proud that I'm doing something, and they love coming home and bonding with the dogs, and they help me walk them. And, you know, the fact that I can, you know, start up my own business and run it, and I'm making some money from it, is very satisfying. Yes, I like doing it for that reason as well.
A good side hustle brings in extra cash. Dough. Moolah. Whatever you call it. Mostly, side hustle money supplements your main income. But sometimes, it's just part of a really big, ambitious competition you have with your friend.
We call it a race to a million.
Carrie is a UX and web designer who works in the corporate world.
We were potatoes and just, you know, watching TV after work and everything. And we both kind of decided this year that needed to change. So we kind of not made a bet per se, but have this competition. It's a race to $1 million in side hustles. The rules of the competition.
Who took the bomb?
A, you're not allowed to use any of the income you make during 9 to 5. So any money you make on that can't be used to generate your side hustle money. So it has to be from scratch, $0. B, you can use anything you earn from your side hustles to reinvest. And C, there's no boundaries. There's, well, everything legally has to be obtained. Being a millennial, I wanted, you know, something instantaneous. I went onto Gumtree. There's a free section. There was free furniture. And what I did was go pick up some of this furniture and made it a little bit better and then resold it at a higher price. Well, I've always kind of been passionate about waste. And then you see it on the streets, you see people picking up. As a kid, I was always like, what the? And now I'm just like, that stuff is gold. It's literally money on the street. So I don't own a car, and it's a little bit hard when I live kind of in the inner west and something's in Bondi to get a bookcase, for example, from Bondi to the inner west on a train. It's a logistical nightmare. I basically had to hammer it down a little bit and carry all the pieces with me, and basically tore my hand apart a little bit with all these splinters. So the person lived on, I think, the 23rd floor of an apartment. So getting in the lift was quite interesting. Once I got down to the lift, the building manager or security was looking at me weird, because they probably never see me in my life, and it looks like I was just, you know, scurrying away with someone's furniture.
Is this a bookcase you've carried by yourself?
Yes.
And you're not, you know, an exceptionally built person.
No, lots of stopping, lots of swearing, lots of kicking the bookcase, wishing it would be easier. And yeah, eventually I got it home.
And have you sold that bookcase?
I have immediately, almost after. $20.
$20. Do you think that $20 was worth the effort?
I should have sold it higher. Yeah. If you think about the amount of time and effort, if you know, how many dollars an hour can you make? that was probably like a 3-hour job. So I did not make much in that per hour.
And what have you sold since?
We sold a washing machine. So that was a cool $180. We sold a dining table and 4 chairs, a matching set. That was $80, I think.
So let me just make this clear. You've sold a washing machine, you've sold a dining set, and you've sold a bookcase, all without a car.
All without a car.
And do you live in a big house?
No, I live in a one-bedroom apartment.
So how do you store all these white goods and all these furniture goods?
I live with it. You know, a washing machine could be a very good dining table sometimes.
And do you know what sort of side hustles your friend has been engaging as part of this competition?
First, they went through their wardrobe and sold all, like, the pieces they didn't want. And then I think they went to use that money to go buy stuff from Vinnie's and stuff. And then they've been, like, learning how to sew and make the pieces nicer and then reselling those as a whole outfit. It's quite a smart idea. I should have thought about that.
How much have you made so far?
Since the beginning of the competition, I've made about $3,000.
And so how long will it take you to get to $1 million?
I hope growth is exponential, not like stable. So if I'm going at the rate I'm going, probably like the rest of my life. But if we are going exponential, I'm hoping within the next 5 years, 5 to 10 years, that's my goal. I like to think I'm an entrepreneur in a way. So I know what people want because that's my day job. I definitely think I'll win.
That story was by Yvonne Lamb, with help from supervising producers Alison Chan and Jordan Fennell. All the Best is a nifty and thrifty place to learn how to produce audio documentaries. If you pitch an awesome story to us, we'll even pay you with the supervising producer. Email us at contact@allthebestradio.com. We'd love to hear from you. In this episode, we're getting thrifty. Because if you're living in an overpriced home and you're short on cash, you often find yourself in a rather sticky situation.
The story of Bluetack begins with the story of Alan Holloway, a hobbyist and worker living in Waterlooville, England, at the turn of the 1970s.
Alan lived in a one-bedroom council flat on a typical modernist housing estate, which was built with sightcast, unpainted reinforced concrete in an 8-story block organised into the form of a ziggurat.
Alan was an activist with the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, a member of the Young Communist League, and a trade unionist.
He was secretary of the local Doctor Who fan club and an active member of the Waterlooville Birdwatching Society.
He played lute and jaw harp in a progressive folk band called the Devil's Advocates.
He was an early supporter of women's liberation and subscribed to many radical journals.
But his day job was as a laboratory researcher for the sealant manufacturer Raleigh Bondite.
One day in 1970, Alan was trying to make a new type of window sealant. He failed to do so, but he found himself with a substance that was pliable and semi-elastic.
Alan realised that this strange new substance could help him to display the many flyers and pieces of ephemera that he had accumulated through his aforementioned hobbies.
CND activism, the Young Communist League, trade unionism, Doctor Who fandom, birdwatching, folk rock and collector of radical feminist literature.
After a few weeks of sticking up posters, Alan began to notice that attendance at Raleigh Bondite's union meetings increased, as did membership of the local Young Communist League and the Waterlooville Birdwatching Society.
When he arrived home each evening from his work at the sealant factory, Alan would open the door to his modernist council flat and see that his walls were festooned with a colourful array of posters and pictures that represented all his favourite hobbies and interests.
Alan Holloway had invented Blu-Tack.
Yay!
Yes.
But he didn't know it yet, nor did he realise the commercial potential of the substance that he had created. What he did realise was that his adhesive had many applications in his daily life.
Alan's friends wanted some of this stuff too, but Alan was a hobbyist and an inventor, not a businessman. He didn't own the means of production by which to enter into large-scale manufacture.
Executives at Raleigh Bondite had noticed Alan's growing habit of sticking his flyers and posters up at work, but they remained disappointed in his failure to produce a new window sealant.
However, when visiting executives from adhesive and sealant manufacturer Bostik saw Alan's workplace flyers for union meetings and upcoming Devil's Advocates gigs, they asked him how he had attached them to the wall without any pins, hooks or other visible fixtures.
Alan told the Bostik executives that he had attached no fixture and showed them his remarkable invention, which left only a slight oily residue when removed from the wall.
The Bostik executives talked excitedly amongst themselves and resolved to purchase the rights to develop this substance.
In the true spirit of positive amateurism, which is not a failure to be professional, but a deliberate deviation from the way in which things are supposed to be done, Alan was happy for his invention to be shared among many more hobbyists than he would be able to reach himself.
He had happy visions of young Communist League members, dog walkers, trade unionists, bird watchers, women's liberationists and folk musicians across the world, united at last in the avocations by this mildly adhesive substance.
In 1971, Alan Holloway sold Bostik the rights to his new invention.
In 1972, the same year that Bostik became available for purchase, the late revolutionary art critic John Berger, rest in power, observed,
"Adults and children sometimes have boards in their bedrooms or living rooms on which they pin pieces of paper, letters, snapshots, reproductions of paintings, newspaper cuttings, original drawings, postcards. On each board, all the images belong to the same language and all are more or less equal within it, because they have been chosen in a highly personal way to match and express the experience of the room's inhabitant. Logically, these boards should replace museums."
But how is a board attached to the wall? It requires a hook or fixture.
Australian rental leases, however, specifically prohibit the use of fixtures, stating that a tenant is
not to attach any fixture or renovate, alter or add to the residential premises without the landlord's written permission.
Because of these rental lease clauses, generations of renters have relied on Blu-Tack and Blu-Tack alone in order to decorate their homes and display the ephemera associated with their pastimes.
Let's contrast the life of a renter in Australia today with the life of Alan Holloway, inventor of Blu-Tack.
Alan's home was purpose-built for workers like him. It was public housing, with rents fixed at an affordable proportion of one's wage.
Today, there is a chronic undersupply of public housing. Most renters are forced into the private rental market no matter how low their income.
Most private rental properties are owned by individual landlords whose main interest is not to provide secure housing, but to make money from their investment properties.
Alan's work at Raleigh Bondite paid a living wage. Alan's wages and conditions at work had been secured by the union activism of people like himself over the course of many years.
Today, work is increasingly casualised, underpaid and insecure. Wages have stagnated and the power of workers to collectively organise has been eroded by harsh anti-union legislation.
The conditions of Alan's housing and employment meant that he didn't have to work exceedingly long hours and didn't feel the stress and anxiety that plagues so many renters and workers today.
The security of Alan's housing afforded him privacy, solitude, and the time and space in which to be himself.
All of these things meant that Alan had the energy to cultivate his many hobbies and interests.
In contrast, today's renter and worker is forced to accept conditions which rob them of time, cause them stress, and inhibit them from making long-term plans.
We have come to an intimate knowledge of these things because as members of the mysterious revolutionary feminist art gang Dexter Fletcher and as failed artists, we live in these conditions of economic precarity.
Our precarity is not unique. It is shared by an increasing number of people with low incomes and high living costs.
In the post-Fordist reality of late capitalism, we find that the semi-elastic pliability, or resilience, of blue tack is also a quality demanded of us.
We have, in effect, become blue tack. And like overused blue tack, we are worn out.
This is the dialectic of blue tack.
Job security and affordable housing is robbed from us.
The market is presented as a natural fact, but as Gang of Four said, natural's not in it.
The mechanisms of the economy are designed by members of a class whose interests are not ours.
We are expected to sell ourselves as eager, willing and happy employees, as entrepreneurs of the self.
Flexibility is the catch cry of bosses and landlords who have the power to exclude us from the markets that they control.
Like teenagers, we dream of an escape that never arrives. And like teenagers, we have little control or power over the forces that direct our lives.
To mitigate these conditions, we use blue tack to decorate our homes with images of the things that are meaningful to us and which represent our identities.
In this way, the walls of our shitty rental properties become the galleries of our lives.
When we move from one rental property to another, we must obliterate these traces of ourselves and wipe the slight oily residue of blue tack from the walls.
Another renter will replace us, and over time, the walls once again become a gallery of their lives.
We have so much in common, and yet we never meet to recognise our shared condition and identity as a class.
What we desire is purchase, not in the sense of consumption or buying a house. We want to take a hold of our lives.
More than just rights, we seek liberation, the chance to live without asking permission.
At the very least, we want to be able to put a fucking hook in the wall.
But meanwhile, we will continue to use blue tack in order to ameliorate the crisis of class society that we find ourselves in.
Our current social relations are defined by competition, and even in our friendships, we sell an image of ourselves to each other and become restless and envious at the images of other people's lives.
In our contemplation of blue tack, we have come to understand that the possibilities for living are infinitely greater than the conditions which we now endure.
Down with professionalisation.
An end to the relentless commercialisation of our cultures, which are our lives, our interests, and our relationships with each other.
A better attitude to adopt would be that of the positive amateurist, who does not fail to get things done, but does not expect or wish for their passions to be commodified.
Blue tack is the enabling tool of the positive amateurist or the hobbyist who pursues their enthusiasm for its own sake.
Just like Alan Holloway did with his many hobbies.
CND activism, the Young Communist League, trade unionism, Doctor Who fandom, birdwatching, folk rock and radical feminist literature. Thank you.
Thank you.
That story was by Dexter Fletcher. Dexter Fletcher is a mysterious feminist art gang of two. This story was recorded at a visual storytelling night hosted by Otherworld Zine Fair and Read to Me in Sydney. The sound recording was by Zasha Rosen. All the Best would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands on which we make these stories and pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging. All the Best is made at FBI Radio in Sydney in association with SYN and 3RRR in Melbourne. Our executive producer is Alison Chan. Our Victorian State Coordinator is Beck Fari. Our Community Coordinator, Chloe Gillespie. Jordan Fennell is our SYN Community Coordinator. Matilda Fay is our social media producer. Tegan Nichols compiles the show. And I'm Samantha Groth, your host. Shining Bird composed our theme music and Annie Hamilton designed the artwork. All the Best is heard across Australia on the Community Radio Network and is made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter and find all our other episodes at allthebestradio.com. We're also a podcast, so subscribe to us on your podcast app. It's totally free, so you'll be nice and thrifty.